Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, it's often been noted that popular art and entertainment can reflect back at us and comment on the culture we inhabit. What then can video games, one of today's most popular entertainment mediums, tell us about the culture produced under neoliberal capitalism? That's the question John Bales attempts to tackle in his book, Ideology and the Virtual City, Video Games, Power Fantasies, and Neoliberalism, available now from Zero Books. John joins us on this edition of the program to discuss how video games like Saints Row 4 and Grand Theft Auto 5 can tell us a little something about the culture of hyper-productivity neoliberal capitalism is producing and the desire to escape that culture before we all reach burnout. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with John Bales, author of Ideology and the Virtual City, Video Games, Power Fantasies, and Neoliberalism. Welcome to Parallax Views, John Bales, author of the new Zero Books title, Ideology and the Virtual City, Video Games, Power Fantasies, and Neoliberalism. It's a very interesting title. How are you doing today, John?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
So this book, Ideology and the Virtual City, I want to define some terms that you use in the title, first and foremost, but maybe you could give a brief summary of what the book is about. This is obviously a Zero Books title. It deals a lot with theory. Maybe you could just give a summary of what you're going for in the book.
Yeah, I mean, well, my background, first of all, is my academic background is in social theory, especially looking at theories of ideology. So that's, you know, that's one area I'm coming from. The other part of it is it's about video games and video games. Well, it's just something that I've done for much of my life playing games. So it's kind of bringing these two things together. It's bringing my kind of theoretical background together with just this my interest in games that sort of sustained for many years. So what I try to do in the book is use video games to illustrate some different what I call ideological positions, which are ways of kind of responding to the dominant demands of modern societies, you know, modern advanced capitalist societies. So I've looked at four different games in the book in terms of how each one represents a different kind of ideological response to the kind of dominant pressures of neoliberalism as an ideology rather than as an economic system. So that's kind of the sort of starting point of it.
I want to define some terms to start out, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could define neoliberalism, because I think it's a term that gets thrown around a lot that mm-hmm. sometimes it's assumed people just understand what it means, but maybe for people that are unfamiliar with the term, I always want to sort of ease them into it and give them a little bit of a primer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, the way I'm using it here is a kind of cultural neoliberalism rather than an economic neoliberalism. But obviously, the cultural neoliberalism comes from the economic and is related to that. You know, so neoliberalism to start with is of course an economic ideology about deregulation, free markets, and so on, privatization, and all that kind of thing, selling off state assets and to private companies, and so on. So I think what comes from that, some of the main kind of ideological things that comes from this neoliberalism, things like sort of the concept of individualism, competition, and personal responsibility. And I think that's what I'm sort of focusing on as the ideology that comes through through the culture of a society which has this economic base, this neoliberal economics as its kind of dominant force in a way. It creates this kind of culture of individualism, competition, and pressure to be personally responsible, to feel personally responsible for every part of your life, the conditions you live in, rather than looking at problems you may face as social problems. It's always individual, it's always personal responsibility. So if things are going wrong in your life, you should feel guilty for it. It's up to you to solve those problems as an individual, not collectively, but always by changing your life at an individual level. So I think that's kind of the crux of it anyway. You know, obviously there's various other aspects that go with that, but it's that individualism and the sense that we're personally responsible for every way that our lives pan out.
I want to come back to that, but first I also want to talk about the term ideology, because I think when people think of the term ideology, they think of, an overt sort of way of thinking that is really explicit, whereas I think ideology can be very covert at some times.
Yeah. I think what I'm talking about here is this kind of neoliberalism as a kind of background ideology. And it's not this kind of doctrine of you must do this, you must behave like this. It's a kind of a set of pressures or demands on you to figure out how to succeed in all these different ways that it asks you to do. For example, you know, it's a lot of competing demands, I think, like to work harder, to consume more, but at the same time also, you know, have family time, look after your health, buy lots of property, save, vote responsibly, consume responsibly, all these different things that kind of contradict each other. So it becomes kind of impossible to satisfy this thing. But it's not an ideology that's telling you you must do this. It's an ideology that's just giving you all these different pressures and leaving you to try and figure it out. But of course, these pressures are all kind of contradictory, so it's impossible to ever sort of meet these demands fully.
You know, a good example of that, not to cut in, but a good example of that is I was reading a New York Times op-ed from a few days ago titled "Don't Just Live Your Life, Optimize It." And it was talking about how, you know, people waste over 20 hours of their life when they could be doing something productive. And I'm thinking to myself, doesn't this sort of conflict with all this talk we hear of work-life balance? I mean, on one hand, we're told to have a balance between work and leisure. On the other hand, we're told that, you could be doing something productive in those 21 hours that you're not using.
Yeah, I think, this is something specific to, you know, neoliberalism as a phase of capitalism. You know, I think there is a sort of the mass consumer capitalism from the phase before that, from the 50s, 60s, 70s, perhaps. I mean, this is just generalization, but it perhaps felt like more like balance was possible. You know, you work to a certain degree, and then you have leisure to a certain degree, and you balance these things. Nowadays, it feels more like you're supposed to do both things but both of them to excess at the same time. So you're supposed to work all the hours that you have and enjoy all the hours you have.
It's demanding the impossible. It's very contradictory.
That's what I think it is. I think it's just, it has all these different demands. So it's, you know, and that's why it's not an ideology in a sense of a strict doctrine. It's an ideology that just places all these demands on you and says it's your responsibility to meet them. And when you can't meet them, therefore, you feel guilty. You feel like you've failed. And every time you feel like you failed, well, you know, it's still up to you to try and figure out how to succeed again, even though it's impossible. So it's just this ongoing cycle. That's kind of the crux of it, I think.
Well, I think that's really key, actually. There's this idea within neoliberal societies that neoliberalism can never possibly be the problem. It's always on the individual. And this system we have now is as good as it gets. And everything has to be on the individual. And not only that, I think within a culture where neoliberalism is sort of dominant, there's, well, I'll quote Margaret Thatcher, there's a mentality of there is no alternative. And I think Mark Fisher also talks about this in Capitalist Realism. I think a big part of this ideology is that there is no other way. It's the end of history, and socialism, the other ideologies have failed. Neoliberalism will sort of be dominant forever, is sort of the idea within the culture.
Yeah, you know, I think this is absolutely one of the main aspects of it, really, is... Yeah, it's exactly that. There is no alternative. You know, what are you going to do? I mean, some of the, I think, you know, a lot of the ideological positions, the kind of responses to this general pressure that I've looked at through these games in the book, I think they're all, what I'm trying to say in the book is that they all sort of, through these games, they're trying to find a way out. But at the same time, they've already internalized this idea that there's no alternative. So, they're trying to find a way out, but they actually can't think beyond what there is. So they're trying to find a way out within it, which is kind of paradoxical. But they don't have the kind of the political, the social imagination to think beyond it, because it's internalized this idea that there's no alternative.
Well, I think it's something we see in both video games and just in day-to-day life. I've talked to a lot of leftists. Mm-hmm. Who will say things like, oh, I feel bad, I'm not being productive enough. And I just feel like there's something really internalized about saying that, this idea that we always have to be productive. I think we should be pushing back on that in some ways. I think we internalize these things, and we can see that within the video games you deal with themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've chosen them to illustrate this, you know, this point amongst other points. But yeah, I think that's... We're all supposed to be productive, but then we're not supposed to be workaholics. You know, there's a point where it becomes bad, and you know, if we're doing too much work, that means we're not spending enough time with our family. We're not enjoying the latest entertainment and so on. But we're always pushed to do more and more and more, and then suddenly it's too much. You know, and then we're pushed the other direction. You know, you should stop working for a while, you should spend time with your family, you should go out and enjoy your social life or whatever. But then you do that too much, and suddenly you've neglected one of the other things. So it's just this constant kind of battle to try and excel in all areas, to try and be a success in all areas, which and every time you push too far, you've neglected one of the other areas. And, you know, that's not right either. You know? And I think this is one of the reasons that people kind of struggle to find, you know, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, and those kind of things. You know, when you haven't got a clear ideology, which isn't, you know, a good thing either a lot of the time, you know, if you have a doctrine that's telling you what to do, that's very stifling as well, of course. But this, on the other hand, isn't, you know, being free from that isn't the solution necessarily, you know.
Well, it's created an environment in which we're all expected to sort of be our own managers and in some cases our own like mini entrepreneurs, and the level of stress that causes, I just don't think it's feasible. I mean, I think it has to give at some point. One thing I find really interesting about the book is that it examines all this through the lens of video games, which I think synchronistically, coincidentally, have the same sort of trajectory as neoliberalism. They both arise in the 1980s.
I think this is, I said this, didn't I, in the book, that video games have basically, yeah, they've grown up with neoliberalism. They haven't really existed, certainly not as a commercial product, pre-neoliberalism. So, you know, compared to other, art forms, like cinema or whatever, that there's not this history beforehand. So, yeah, they've grown up with it. They've grown up with this this entrepreneurial idea of how they're supposed to be created and produced, and with a generation who have also grown up with these neoliberal ideas of competition and so on. And it's, you know, it's interesting. It doesn't mean that all video games are neoliberal necessarily. There may be certain aspects of the way games work which kind of work in tune with neoliberal ideas. But, you know, of course, they can be critical as well. Sometimes, like the ones in the book, in flawed ways. But and there are examples of games that sort of manage to reflect on what they are and how they are in tune with neoliberalism and criticize that from within.
Are there any maybe specific examples you could give of a video game that maybe is in tandem with neoliberalism or sort of works in tandem with it?
All the examples in the book are to an extent. You could put it another way. There are games in general have this kind of instrumentalist mentality, which can often work in tune with neoliberalism. So when in a game, it is very much about your goals, your personal goals. You know, it's a game, so you have rules and you have a mission or a quest to complete and you're attempting to do that. And everything you do is a step towards that goal. And it doesn't really concern you what you're actually doing, what the sort of moral consequences are of what you're doing. All you're asked to figure out is what's the next step to your goal. You know, if you need to kill another character in the game to gain a new power or a new weapon or something that's going to help you, that's kind of like, you think of it very instrumentally. It's like, well, I should do that then because it's going to help me reach my goal. You don't have to think about others. You often don't have to think about the consequences of your actions unless that's kind of hard programmed into the game as well. So I think that works in tandem with this kind of idea of individualism, just thinking about your own goals in a very kind of instrumentalist way. You know, what do I need to do? How do I use everything around me to reach this next goal? So I think that is kind of hard-coded into a lot of games. You know, other than games that, you know, there are cooperative games where you can play with other players cooperatively as well. But, you know, certainly the ones I'm talking about in the book, they're all single-player games that work like that. So, you know, if a game is going to be kind of critical of neoliberalism, one thing I think it has to do is kind of to recognize how it functions, how it's getting you to work in this very individualistic way, and perhaps play on that and comment on that in some way.
Well, one interesting thing is that you're not just focused necessarily on video games, but you're focused on something specific within those games, namely their representation of modern cities, or what you refer to in the title as the virtual city. Why do you find an interest in the virtual city, and how does it play into your book?
Yeah, I think in this case it was more that, you know, these are all games which have a modern city as their main setting. And I think in this case, it's just that was kind of the easiest parallel to draw, because they are representing modern life. You know, it's not a very abstract, distant remove from modern life. You can see that what they're actually doing is creating I think in most cases, an American city, one of them is a Japanese city. So yeah, they're creating a modern urban landscape, and that obviously is a mirror, therefore, to the society we live in, you know, as opposed to if it was a fantasy scenario or a sci-fi scenario that might be a bit more distant from that. So I just thought that was, you know, the best way to look at it. And modernity, if you're looking at modernity, it's always kind of represented by the city. It's the urban center. That's the kind of hub of technology. That's the that's where the, you know, the civilization is at its peak in a way, or at its most fervent and together, you know, at that point. So yeah, I think that was it really. I think that was why I wanted to look at cities. And one thing I think that's interesting about them, you look at each of these four games, even the way that you move around the city in these games, the character you play, shows them to be different. And even the architecture, the way the city itself is laid out, and the kind of things that tell you something about its kind of interpretation of modern city life, or, you know, modern late capitalist life.
Well, another thing I find interesting about the modern city is that it's sort of, and I think you're alluding to this, is it's sort of ground zero for this sort of cultural neoliberalism that you've talked about. I think it's where everyone's sort of working themselves to death. There's sort of a dystopianism to the modern city in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think you would probably look at most of these, well, certainly some of these examples here as dystopian. I mean, they might have a kind of a utopian element in the sense that they're trying to I think, fix some kind of contradiction that they haven't quite been able to name and been able to formulate. So that's why it's kind of takes this sort of virtual form. So there is a kind of some kind of utopian idea, even if it's a bit sort of stunted somehow, or, you know, a problem that needs to be solved. But I just don't think these games are kind of actually, you know, formulating it clearly. So it's like, yes, there's a problem. There's a, you know, there's a storyline and a quest, and the character is trying to achieve something. And it kind of represents something that isn't really, hasn't been fully kind of defined by the game. You know, you can kind of see it trying to grapple with these ideas and not quite being able to see the whole picture in a way, I suppose. And, you know, therefore you get this kind of this sort of allegorical representation of the problems of modern life, and a kind of, and they often, I think they end, all these games, they end with a kind of failure to really resolve the problems they're trying to tackle because they haven't been able to quite name and work out what they are. So, yeah, I think that comes through in all of them.
I also want to get into the actual examples. I will list them off real quickly for folks. Saints Row 4 from 2013, Grand Theft Auto 5 from 2013, No More Heroes from 2008, and Persona 5 from 2017. I'm not as familiar with these games because I'm not that big into gaming culture, but I want to get into why you chose these games. But before we do that, another important aspect of this book is the examination of power fantasies. Could we discuss that a little bit, the role of power fantasies in these games?
Yeah, I think actually that probably just ties into what I was just saying, that it feels like, yeah, because they're kind of unable to really identify the contradiction in the society. And so it's a sort of a fantasy version of it. And the games are kind of offering us as players as well this way of solving the problem of modern life by giving us powers that we wouldn't normally have in real life. You know, so the characters we play in these games, they're able to do things that we can't do in real life.
Isn't there a term you mentioned that video game theorists have called ludonarrative dissonance? Does that relate to this, or
That's more to do with how the story and the actual playing of the game relate to each other. So you know, you can have the story that the game is trying to tell, and it often tells a story through sort of non-interactive cutscenes where you just see dialogues between characters and events play out, and then you will switch to a part of the game when you're actually playing and trying to achieve something. And sometimes those things don't quite match up. You know, the goals of the character in the cutscene, in the cinematic part, don't actually seem to match with what you're doing in the game. You know, there's a classic example is a game called Uncharted, which it's a kind of Indiana Jones style adventure. You have this kind of, you know, Indiana Jones type character who's, you know, he's cocky and he makes quips and stuff like that, and he's going on this archaeological adventure. And then when you get to the gameplay, it's basically loads of shooting. You know, you're killing like dozens and dozens of people, and it doesn't quite match up. So I think that's where it sort of came from originally. And I just think it's interesting in some of these games here, the way this you get this kind of dissonance between the story, you know, what the game is saying, and what you're actually doing in it. So that's what that is really. And I think it can reveal certain things about the game, about the themes and what it's sort of unconscious themes, I suppose you would say.
But the power fantasies within these games, you see them as sort of largely unconscious attempts to resolve the social issues we face within a neoliberal culture. I want to maybe clarify that. And also, you are very interested in two thinkers in this regard, Frederick Jameson and Slavoj Žižek. And I believe Žižek has actually given a blurb for your book. Maybe you could talk a little about those theorists and the relation they have to your book.
Yeah, I mean, these are two theorists that I've looked at a lot in my academic work. With Jameson in particular, I think one of the things he's looked at with cinema, you know, some time back in the 90s, was this idea that of films, particularly films that were about kind of conspiracies and so on, were unable to really represent the reality. So the only way they could represent it was through allegory. I can't think of the examples now, but yeah, films that were about kind of conspiracy theory type thing, you know, conspiracies where someone is trying to fight against, you know, dark unseen power and so on. And he was trying to say that this is, you know, this is the only way that we can kind of represent reality these days through art, is through these kind of allegories. And although they fail to obviously represent the actual real problem, they are at least an attempt to do it. They show a kind of unconscious attempt to do it, and therefore suggest that a need to try again, to try harder, try differently.
Much like how you see video games being unable to explicitly recognize or formulate an understanding of the social issues they may be trying to understand.
Yeah, and you know, I think you know part of that you have to say is, well, they're not actually really trying to do that. You know, it's not like they're consciously trying to do a critique of capitalism of failing. They're unable to kind of name the system, you know, whether it's neoliberalism or capitalism, that is the source of the problem they're dealing with. You know, so they're sort of they're seeing it in a sort of narrower term, and they're not really able to kind of, or you know, trying to look at this in a larger way, you know, and, you know, perhaps there's no reason why they should, you know, they're not sort of setting out to be anti-capitalist or whatever.
Well, I mean, they're produced by corporations.
Sure, yeah, of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the first game you cover, and I am familiar with the franchise, but I haven't played mm-hmm. this game, is Saints Row 4. Why mm-hmm. this game and why the focus on it in the first chapter? Why do you choose to sort of introduce this game? It's the first game you cover, so why mm-hmm. that one?
Yeah, well, you know, each of the four is supposed to represent a different kind of response to this the neoliberal ideology, background ideology. So it was important that each of these games did represent a different response. In my academic work, I've dealt with like these different responses to ideology and come up with kind of different ideological positions, the ways that we try to cope with demands and pressures of neoliberal background ideology.
Yeah, I think you come up with four distinct responses.
In this book, there's four of those. Saints Row represents here, what I call hedonism, which is one response. That would be a response that basically, we focus on consumerism, we focus on enjoying ourselves, try to block out all the other pressures and so on. And I think this is in Saints Row. This is Saints Row 4 I'm talking about here. So obviously it's a series of games. And as the series goes on, it gets increasingly more kind of hedonistic. It's more about just wild, chaotic enjoyment. Saints Row are, they're a gang. And in the original games, you play as this gang and you're fighting against other gangs in this open city environment. And it just gets more and more sort of ridiculous. It's just silly and ridiculous and so on. By this fourth game, what actually happens is, they come up with this plot about aliens invading the world and destroying the world. And your character, who has by this point become the president of America, is put in this simulation of a city. So it's not the real city anymore. And the way you can play in this city, because it's not real, because it's, even in the fiction of the game, it's not real. It's a virtual city within the virtual city, in a sense. You're not sort of limited by the boundaries of normal human power. So you can run super fast, you can leap over buildings, you can, you can just sort of fly around and jump around and bounce around and so on. And the city itself becomes kind of just like a playground, really.
Isn't the city like supposed to be based on like a 1950s sitcom, Pleasantville? I think it's what it's called in the game.
There is it's a part of that just at the start of the game. When you first put into this this virtual city, the plot's kind of, it's ridiculous to explain it, but the plot is that these aliens have blown up the world, they've created this city and trapped you in it. And to begin with, they trap you in this kind of 1950s sitcom.
Where there's no violence or foul language, yeah.
Yeah, and to keep you under control, basically. But quite quickly, actually, you escape it and start running amok around this alien-created virtual city. And when you do, you get access to these sort of superpowers, and you just start trying to destroy the aliens and just generally have fun as well, just driving cars recklessly and whatever. And there's very little kind of risk or consequence to your actions. It's very difficult. You don't really die. The people in the city are no longer real people. They're just simulations. So it doesn't really matter if you accidentally run into them or whatever. It's a kind of a fantasy of this unfettered hedonism. You can just enjoy yourself constantly, just have fun, just be chaotic, just be violent. It doesn't matter. It's like unleashing the pleasure principle, and just sort of just go for it. And I've contrasted it in the book with the previous game, Saints Row 3, Saints Row the Third, it's called, which is very similar, but still set in, its idea of the real world, of actual America. And it does the same thing. It lets you run around hedonistically, just acting chaotically, destroying things and so on. But the thing with that is, I think, that it has, because it's still set supposedly in a reality, everything has consequences. And throughout the game, it's trying to ignore these consequences, trying to ignore the negative side of all this destruction and so on. So for me, I thought Saints Row 4 was kind of a way to escape this. A way to have all the good stuff, all the fun, all the hedonism, and get rid of the downsides, get rid of all the destruction, the actual destruction, the people being killed, the innocent bystanders being killed, and so on. And that's, that's kind of the fantasy, is that you can have this, that there is this ideal version of a modern capitalist world where you can just fulfill its hedonistic demands all the time and never have to worry about anything else. But of course, how did it get there? The only way it could realize this was by destroying the world and creating a virtual version of the world. You know, this, you cannot have this consumerism in reality without the downsides.
It kind of reminds me of the Matrix in a way. Mm-hmm. And I guess, because, well, I say the Matrix because, you know, none of the characters are actually in the real world most of the time. It's sort of this virtual consumerist sort of world that they're sort of pushed into. Although I guess Saints Row is different because, as you said, it's more, there's more freedom. It's the city as playground, as opposed to where in the movie The Matrix, it's sort of, you know, a hell for a lot of the characters.
Yeah, until you understand how to use it properly and how to manipulate it, and then you can, you know, you're free to do what you want. But then, of course, you're pursued by the the bad guys, aren't you? So I don't know. It's been a while since I've seen The Matrix. But yeah, I mean, obviously there are sort of parallels there. But I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, to come back to Jameson, you know, one of his famous quotes, I mean, Zizek has always also said this as well. I think it comes from Jameson originally. The oft-quoted idea that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And I think that's kind of literally made true in the difference between Saints Row the Third and Saints Row Four, in that the only way, you know, it can't imagine its way out of capitalism. It can imagine the end of the world in order to try and realize this dream, but it's still capitalism. Even there, it's following. When you're in this sort of hedonistic paradise, it's following very capitalist ideas of what enjoyment is, of what pleasure is, of what happiness is. It's about fast cars. It's about, you know, ridiculous outfits and destruction and violence and so on, and personal pleasure. And so even once you've got rid of the actual world and the actual capitalist system, what they've taken into this utopia are still very capitalist ideas, you know. So it's, in the end, it's still kind of the same thing, even though they've managed to, even though it's within a completely new world. So the utopia is, it hasn't escaped, it still hasn't escaped neoliberalism, it still hasn't escaped capitalism. And at the end of the game, if I remember, I think, you know, once you've kind of, you do destroy the aliens, I think, and, you know, but the world is still destroyed. So it's just a group of people left on a spaceship with a hope of trying to, I suppose, repopulate the world, or, you know, find a new world and repopulate it and so on. But they're still left with the same ideas. They still have the same ideas of what, you know, what pleasure is and what fun is and what happiness is. So they haven't overcome that.
Which means they're just going to reproduce neoliberalism again.
They're going to do it again. Probably, yeah. I mean, that's what it would suggest, yeah, that the cycle will just repeat. They haven't actually, they didn't overcome the problems of that society. It just got destroyed, which is not the same thing.
So I guess that's why the subtitle to this chapter on Saints Row 4 is "The City is Playground," but that playground sort of is folded back into neoliberalism.
Yeah, it's one of the pressures, one of the demands of neoliberalism is hedonism. It's to enjoy yourself. It's to keep up with entertainment. It's to, you know, it's to drink and take drugs and so on, you know. But for neoliberalism, that's just one thing. You're also supposed to work hard and be responsible and so on at the same time. So it's just this kind of hedonistic response to neoliberalism is it's really focusing very much on one aspect or one of these pressures, and it's trying to sort of block out the others. But this is, you know, in the game, this is the only way it can be realized, is actually by, you know, removing all these pressures, by destroying the world and creating this kind of utopia, which is actually a virtual reality.
I guess in contrast, the second game you cover is Grand Theft Auto V, which mm-hmm. relates to the ideological position of cynical self-interest. And I like the subtitle of that chapter, "The City as Battleground." That's in stark contrast to "The City as Playground" with Saints Row mm-hmm. 4.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think people would probably, I mean, anyone who has read Zizek, you know, he talks a lot about cynicism as a kind of ideology. oh, you know, you mentioned Mark Fisher, capitalist realism. I mean, that has some aspects of this. It's cynicism is the idea that, you know, we know how bad everything is. We know exactly what's going on. We know capitalism is the problem, but we can't do anything about it. You know, it's too powerful. Or if we try and do anything about it, things will only get worse. It's back to that there is no alternative again. It's like, look what happened in the Soviet Union. So there's no point trying to try a different system, because that's what happens. That's what happens when you try and plan an economy. It just goes completely wrong and everyone ends up in the gulag, you know. So we have to accept what we've got. But it's cynical because I think it often comes from people who have a certain level of privilege in that system and therefore can afford to say that let's keep things the way they are. You know, it's it's like, you know, why would you want to take the risk if you've got more to lose than to gain, or it seems like you've got more to lose than to gain? You know, and you can justify it by saying, well, things will be just as bad or worse. You know, perhaps the people in power will be different, but, you know, in the end, I mean, one of the common arguments is, oh, it's human nature. Humans are greedy and selfish, and look at history, it's always like this, whatever we try and do, you know. And it's right to an extent, you know. It's not an irrational kind of position to a great extent, but it does ignore that people have fought for better conditions in the past. You know, it doesn't mean that there's been a perfect society that we should emulate, but, you know, throughout history, people have improved the quality of their lives by fighting for it, by demonstrating, by, you know, protesting, by demanding things. And so for someone to say, well, there's nothing we can do, it's just the way it is, you know, just accept, you know, maybe we can make some small changes here and there. We can tinker with, you know, different levels of things, and, you know, but we can't upset the balance, really, you know. I think that's kind of the basis of it. And so, you know, it's come to Grand Theft Auto 5. I mean, it, you know, Grand Theft Auto, first thing to say about it is it's probably the biggest video game franchise there is, certainly one of them anyway. I mean, this particular game, it's made, you know, it's made billions. It's, I think it actually might be like the biggest selling, or, you know, most profitable piece of media entertainment of all, of anything, you know, I mean, of all media. Something like that, anyway. And the series is always about, you know, you play a gangster or a crook, a criminal. You generally start off low level, and throughout the course of the game, you rise up, and by the end of the game, you're very wealthy, you own lots of property, and you're into much bigger criminal enterprises. And so, I mean, as a fantasy, what it's really saying is, well, there's no way out of this system. I should also say, actually, it's also very critical of capitalism, particularly this game, which I sort of see as the kind of the post-financial crisis, post-bailout version of Grand Theft Auto. And it's hard on capitalism. It's, you know, it knows that capitalism is the problem.
In what way is it hard on it? I haven't had a chance to play the game. I may have listeners that are unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it is critical of capitalism. It's very critical of big business, for example. You know, you're actually often sort of coming up against sort of big business, like legitimate businesses in the game, whether it's a social media company or a weapons manufacturer or whatever. These are some of the major adversaries you come up against in the game. And I mean, what it always does, I think, and what Grand Theft Auto has always done, is try to show that the legitimate business people are actually no different from the criminals that you're controlling. You know, they're kind of the same, except that what they do is considered acceptable and what you do isn't. So that's how they create these kind of, you are kind of this anti-hero, in the sense that, you know, nobody's pretending what you're doing is okay, but at least you're being honest about it. At least you're upfront about what you're doing. You're not hiding behind, you know, legalities and so on. And, you know, there's a lot of little scenarios in the game which, you know, it's just about, you know, how businesses work and, you know, some of the poverty and so on. But what it's, but you know, because it's sort of saying, well, there's no alternative, that this is all there is, you know, it's unable to, doesn't even attempt to kind of imagine an alternative, I don't think. So all you can do, the best you can do, the kind of the utopian fantasy vision is, as an individual, you can win in this society. As an individual, you can take advantage of all that's, all the corruption, even if you can see what's going on, even if you see how bad it is, well, the best you can do is try and succeed within that system.
In that way, it's very dystopian.
In that, yeah, it is. It, in a way, yeah, it is. I mean, it's the only, there isn't really a utopia, like a social utopia. There's just a sort of a personal ideal. You know, personally, you can make it. That's all there is, really. That's the best it can really offer. So, yeah, so throughout the game, the characters you play, they rise up and they become wealthy criminals by doing bigger and bigger crimes and so on. And, you know, often competing against, you know, so-called legitimate business people and so on. So that's where it is. So it criticizes capitalism, but in a way that there's nothing we can do about it. And I think the other thing about it, the way it criticizes capitalism, it doesn't really look at the actual power relations and say, well, you know, it's these people's fault. Or, I mean, everyone you meet in Grand Theft Auto, and this is why I've entitled it The City's Battleground, when you walk down the streets, everyone seems hostile. Everyone seems aggressive. Everyone just sort of is just shouting something that they want. They're completely trapped in their own personal bubble, unable to think of what other people may want. Everyone just seems to want something of everyone else and be ready to fight everyone else all the time. So despite this critique of capitalism, it just seems that everyone is terrible. Everyone is awful. Doesn't matter if they're rich or poor or whatever. It's just that we're all bad. And therefore, you know, there is no kind of possibility of any kind of collective, you know, action. So it's just, it's all against all, you know, and you're just trying to survive and you're just trying to make the most of it, you know, and that's kind of how it sees capitalism. And the best you can do is survive.
Do you think that's why the Grand Theft Auto franchise has sort of generated such controversy over the years, maybe in a small part? I mean, I think there's more obvious reasons why it has been controversial and created a media uproar every time there's a new Grand Theft Auto game. But I'm curious as to your thoughts on the sort of, you know, people pulling out the pitchforks every time a new Grand Theft Auto game comes out.
Well, I think it's cynical as a product as well. I think it knows exactly what it's doing. It certainly does these days anyway. It's it's trying to court a certain kind of controversy. You know, it wants to annoy the kind of the more conservative, puritanical people, because it knows that its audience is mainly, you know, young, male, you know, sort of media savvy, technology savvy people. And who are, you know, they're not necessarily progressive politically, but they're not really conservative either. You know, they're not sort of culturally conservative people. You know, it's similar to something like South Park, you know, as a kind of the way it kind of, you know, it sort of mocks sort of social conservatism, you know, and sort of more traditionalist attitudes, I suppose you would say. So it's always mocking that sort of thing. And it knows what it's doing. It knows how to court that kind of controversy with violence and sex and so on. And this kind of satirical elements in the game, you know, sort of mocking the religious right and so on. You know, it knows what it's doing there. I mean, you know, the thing, of course, because it's such a huge, successful product, you know, this is a big corporate product, you know, and it's throughout the game, it's showing how awful these corporations are, but it's made by one of these corporations, you know, as you said earlier, you know, this is the kind of contradiction. Or it seems like a contradiction, but then is it really? Because the message of the game is there's nothing we can do to change this system. All we can do is, you know, use it to our advantage as best we can and make the most of it as we can. And that is what the corporation is doing at the end of the day.
The sort of Scarface mentality that I see among a lot of, like, young males, especially young teenage males, this mentality of, well, the system's out against us and there is no sort of morality, so I'm just going to get mine. There isn't really an idea of collective action.
Yeah, yeah. And even the corporation making the game is, in the end, doing this. That is exactly what they're doing. You know, there's various controversies outside the content of the game about the taxes that, you know, that they legally, of course, but they don't pay taxes in the UK where the game is made, you know, and those sort of things. And, I mean, the game's online mode, you know, it's a Grand Theft Auto Online, which is part of the game. They have a lot of, you know, what's called microtransactions, which is in-game just selling with real money lots of points so you can buy little things in the game like new clothes or new cars or whatever. And this becomes, you know, you get people into the game and then you're trying to just constantly get them to spend more real money, which is, you know, ethically a grey area, certainly. You know, so they're, you know, they're, as a corporation, they're into all this stuff. But as a corporation, well, as a game, the message is, well, you do what you can. You get as much as you can, you know. So there's no kind of contradiction, really.
So that's representing cynical self-interest in the city as Battleground. If we can, maybe we can briefly cover the last two games you cover.
Sure, yeah.
The first one is No More Heroes, which represents what you call escapist defeatism, and it's the city as wasteland. I actually am unfamiliar with this game. Maybe you could tell me a little bit more about it.
Yeah, it's probably certainly much more niche than Grand Theft Auto. It's so it's a Japanese-made game, even though it's set in an American city, and it's the city. The name of the city is Santa Destroy, and, you know, as that sounds, it's kind of this very empty kind of urban sprawl, kind of West Coast urban sprawl. When you're in the part of the game when you're just moving around the city, there's barely anything to do. It's kind of lacking in any kind of content or meaning. The people that walk in the streets, they're just kind of these faceless people who don't interact with you. You know, so this is kind of everyday city life. It's without any kind of purpose, it feels, without any kind of content. The other side of the game, the main character gets drawn into, or supposedly drawn into, this contest where he becomes a hired assassin, and he has to fight all these other hired assassins to become the number one ranked hired assassin in the world. It's, you know, it's completely ridiculous, but the character is, he's very stupid and gullible and goes along with this. And he himself is very obsessed with video games. And so I think when he finds this thing, it seems it had to have a purpose. It has the kind of shape of a video game quest, and to that means something to him. And therefore he can follow it and he can understand it, and it's meaningful, unlike the outside world when you're just driving around this empty city. So when you're actually in these missions, you know, you're fighting against people, you're following a singular path, a linear path towards this goal. So it's directed, it's purposeful. The rest of the city is aimless, it's empty. But what he's doing, of course, is he's escaping into video games. He's escaping into hobbies. He's escaping into you know, popular culture. You know, he's obsessed with wrestling and games and porn and all this kind of stuff, and he's just escaping into that. So, and it turns out in the end that even this thing that he's doing isn't even real. It's a fiction after all. It was made up just to get money out of him. It's a scam. And one of the interesting things about it, I think, that connects this together is the fact that in order to keep competing in these matches, these assassin matches, he has to take jobs in the real city and earn real money and then pay to get into these ranked matches. So even when he's escaping, he can't really escape. He has to keep coming back to the real economy and doing tedious jobs. And the game actually makes you do some of these tedious jobs for a while, which kind of sort of, you know, makes the point clear, I think. I think that's what's interesting about it. So as an ideology, you know, I think there is a kind of way that people just escape into popular culture, or, you know, whether it's games or films or whatever. But it's not really an escape. It's a false escape, I think. And it's in the end, you're back in the real world, and you haven't really solved anything.
I would definitely agree with that. I see that in a lot of, in the real world now with, you know, there's a whole segment of people I know who will obsess over whatever new movie comes out and argue about whether it's woke enough or not. And I'm like, I see these videos from people who will complain about the latest movie, like Birds of Prey, being too woke or whatever. And, you know, you just see in the background Funko Pop toys and all these consumerist items. And I'm thinking to myself, you guys have really not even become political. What you're doing is that you're sort of escaping into this culture war politics through movies. It's not really an issue for most normal people. Most people are just trying to survive the 9-to-5.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's it. You know, and this I suppose, is what they call geek culture is a big part of this. And this is what the game is mocking. But at the same time, it knows it's a part of it as well. It's quite an interesting interesting game in that respect. I think it knows what it's doing, and yet it's, you know, it's mocking the thing that it is at the same time. But it, at the same time, in the end, I don't think it can find a way out of it itself. You know, even though it's quite aware of what's going on and the problems of this geek culture, it's unable to offer anything other than this temporary escape, because it can't really, you know, identify the system as the problem in the first place. So it comes back to the same thing as I suppose with the other games.
And the final game you cover is another game I'm not actually as familiar with, and that is Persona 5, and that represents the ideological position of reformism, and the subtitle is The City as Prison. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that chapter.
Yeah, well, it's quite a lot to talk about with Persona. It's hard to summarize because it's a very large game with a lot of like characters and story, so it deals with a lot of different themes, so it's hard to sort of boil it down. But what it is, this one's actually set in Tokyo. It's a Japanese game that came out a few years ago. And you, these games, these Persona games, you tend to play as a high school student, and part of it is dealing with regular everyday high school life, socializing and studying and so on. You have to make choices about which of those to prioritize, you know, or, you know, do you go out and try and build up certain personal attributes like your courage or whatever, or your intelligence. So there's always this juggling of real life side of it, but at the same time there's always this supernatural side of it as well, where you get sort of taken into this sort of parallel dimension and you have to fight monsters and so on, and the two kind of end up intertwining with each other. So your choices in the real world will affect your abilities to succeed in the parallel dimension, and vice versa. In this game, you arrive in Tokyo at the start of the game as a teenage boy who is on probation after being found guilty of assault, a crime he didn't commit, but even so, he's been sent there by his parents for a year, and he's being sent to this strict academy that he has to attend. And at the start of the game, you basically don't really have many options about where to go. You're restricted to very small areas of the city. So even though you're in this big city with everything it promises, all the entertainment and distractions and so on, the game opens up very slowly. You're always in these little districts that are walled off. You can't just freely move around the place. So that's one way in which it's like a prison. Obviously, literally, you're on probation, so you're being watched. You can't, you've got to be careful not to break the rules and so on. But yeah, as an ideology, I'm wondering how much I have to explain here because there's quite a lot to it. But I think what it's about is, I mean, the fact that you've been found guilty of assault and put on probation, you know, it's a crime he didn't commit. A lot of it is about the injustice of the elite being able to use their positions of power, you know, exploit their positions of power to, you know, exploit the little people, the youth. You know, it's a very youth-centered game. So in a way, the youth are kind of the oppressed class against, you know, the elite. And at various points in the game, you come up against different authority figures, whether it's in the school, in business world or in politics or in the legal profession, these different people who represent elite power and the corruption of elite power and are kind of oppressing you. But through this parallel dimension, you take on these special powers and you become able to affect the real world, and you'll be able to actually attack these corrupt individuals and change their personalities and force them to admit what they've done wrong in reality. And so you gain this power. So this is the power fantasy that you can actually do something about this elite corruption. You can actually challenge it. But the reason I think it's reformist and it's not really, it doesn't really in the end manage to change society, because it is focusing on individuals as the representations. You know, it's not the system itself that's ever called into question. It's always the corrupt individuals within it. So that's why I see it as this kind of liberal reformism that's always looking to find the specifics rather than look at the bigger picture. So I think that's kind of, I suppose that's kind of the main ideological point about it.
Well, then I guess starting to wrap up and maybe conclude, all of these games, I suppose what you're saying is that they each give an insight into the psychology of folks under a neoliberal culture, but these films also don't necessarily completely challenge neoliberalism. As you say, they're not fully critical and not fully conformist, but they do end up sort of reaffirming neoliberalism. Is there any way that video gaming can maybe get outside of that box?
Yeah, I suppose what I would say about them is that they all end up viewing the problem, you know, still within some of the ideas of neoliberalism, such as there is no alternative, or, you know, the problem is individual rather than systemic and so on. I mean, I think in terms of what games can do, I think often it is, there is the cooperative element for a start. I think that's important when you look at multiplayer games, how they, you know, there are different ways that they can create a kind of collective effort towards a goal, you know, that they set out in the game. So that's, you know, that's one way of doing that. And, you know, not all games are about competing. Other than that, I think on a sort of more perhaps, you know, sort of narrative and thematic level, I think it's more about sort of recognizing what they are and sort of being able to reflect on themselves in what they're doing. You know, games are, certainly, you know, single player games, they are about the illusion of agency. You know, they give you the idea that you're in control, that you're the one making the story happen, making the story unfold. But actually, the stories are kind of pre-written and sort of fixed in place a lot of the time. So, you know, one thing you can do is kind of reflect within the game on that dynamic. And the fact that the game is controlling you, and therefore to at least ask the question, well, what can you do? You know, how do you change this? How do you challenge this? Are you just going to keep following this path that's been set out for you? Or do you, you know, do you stop playing the game? Do you refuse to play the game and actually say, hold on a minute, let's try something else? You know, and I think, I mean, a game that I just wrote about recently is a game called Control, which is very much about, you know, it has a lot, of course, it has all these themes of control. And I think it's a lot of it is about whether you, the character, are in control, or whether the different elements in the game are controlling you, are directing you, are making you do what they want to do. And I think the question is, so how do you break that? You know, how do you really take control? And perhaps it's not in the game, but perhaps the game at least asks the question. You know, perhaps the option isn't in the game to, you know, because it's not hard coded into the game. You can't suddenly just reject the system that it's created and start a revolution. To start a revolution, you've got to stop playing. But the game can make you ask that question: how do I stop playing? How do I get out of the game, in a way?
And I found it interesting. You start off the book with a quote from one of the characters from Persona 5, and the quote is, if you want to change the world, all you have to do is just look at it differently. Why do you start the book off with that? I'm just curious.
Well, I think it is the beginning of changing the world. You know, if the first thing you do have to do, if you do want to make a change, you have to be able to see it differently. You have to, if you want to get out of neoliberalism or whatever the dominant ideological background is, first thing you've got to do is be able to think of something that isn't that. You've got to be able to picture an alternative. And this is one of the things that neoliberalism has made very difficult for us to do. But my, you know, the point that I lead on to from there is to talk about how in the game, it actually doesn't do this, even though it sort of makes this point. It knows that you have to look at the world differently. It actually doesn't manage to look at the world differently enough to change it, or not to change it as much as it can or as much as it might want to. What it ends up with is a kind of temporary change, but you can see that it's just going to revert to the way it was before. It hasn't really dealt with the core issues, the underlying problems. So, you know, my point is, yes, you have to look at it differently, but, you know, you've got to perhaps more differently than that even, you know, than it does in the game. But, yeah, it's really that. I think that is the kind of starting point for political change. Is there an idea of something else? You know, is there something different that you can picture? You know?
Well, I want to thank you again, John Bills, for coming on Parallax Views. Maybe you could tell my listeners how they can get a hold of Ideology and the Virtual City, and what you really, maybe in closing, want them to get out of it.
Yeah, well, it's available from you know, most retailers, I think, online, and probably a few bookshops as well. Certainly, you know, places like Amazon or the publisher's website, johnhunt.com, I think that is. What do I hope people get out of it? Well, I think it's really that way of, well, certainly, first of all, looking at thinking of neoliberalism as that kind of background set of pressures on us, and the contradictory nature of it, and how it makes us think very individually, and also, you know, creates something, a demand that's impossible to fulfill, and therefore makes us feel guilty about it, and so on. But then also to look at some of these common ways in which we often people interpret that and sort of see the problems in that they don't get to the root of the issue, that the root of the issue is, you know, whether it's capitalism itself or certainly the neoliberal version of capitalism. And we have to try and think beyond that. We have to think of the alternative, you know, what is the alternative? Other than that, I think perhaps I hope people will get an idea about video games and how they can sort of convey themes and ideas and tell stories in different ways as well to other media. You know, I'm not talking about stories in the same way that films tell stories or books tell stories, TV. The combination of, you know, traditional narrative elements and cinematography and music and so on with these interactive elements and how they create different and interesting relationship and different ideas through that. So I hope, you know, all those things will come across. You know, it's a short book and it's just an introduction to all these kind of ideas, but I hope they do come across to some extent.
Well, thank you again, John Bills, author again of Ideology in the Virtual City, for coming on Parallax Views.
Okay, thank you for having me on. It's been good talking to you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Hope you enjoyed the conversation with John Bills on his book, Ideology and the Virtual City, Video Games, Power Fantasies, and Neoliberalism, available now from Zero Books. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at Patreon.com/ParallaxViews. It is you, my faithful listeners, that keep this project going. And in these difficult times, I really appreciate the support, especially from Martin, Mark, Emilia, Brace, and John, all of whom get a producer's credit at the $10 tier of my Patreon. Thank you so much for supporting the show. And with that being said, Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.